This episode of Zero to Travel is brought to you by the 2024 Nissan Pathfinder with 7 drive modes. The Pathfinder's available intelligent 4x4 is built for even the most epic journeys. Learn more at NissanUSA.com. What is the one thing you absolutely cannot leave at home when you go traveling? You have to have it with you. I'm not talking about the obvious stuff, right? You want to have your underwear and your clothes. And actually, I traveled with a guy once that didn't have underwear, but that's another story. But I'm talking about the one sort of you could live without it, but you need to bring it thing. I'll share mine. And I've got a special interview for you today in which my guest shares his. And what makes his so interesting is this is the only person to travel to every country in the world at least twice. He's visited every country in the world twice, and he's done it while having a full-time job. We talk about how he did that, and I was shocked to hear what his one thing was. I'd never heard this before and probably will never hear it again. So you'll hear that in this interview. We talk about some of his travel records and why he doesn't even consider them travel records, the only country without a hotel which he slept in, and how he slept in it. And we get into the topic of the least visited countries in the world, which is a book he wrote. And it's only in Norwegian right now. It's not available in English yet. But he chronicles the least visited countries in the world. And this was fascinating to me because I love to visit places that haven't hit really hard in terms of big numbers of tourists visiting. Of course, you want to get to those places sooner than later. So you're going to find out which of the world's least visited countries you should consider visiting. It's all happening right now, my friend. Thank you so much for being here and welcome to the Zero to Travel podcast.
You're listening to the Zero to Travel podcast, where we explore exciting travel-based work, lifestyle, and business opportunities, helping you to achieve your wildest travel dreams. And now your host, world wanderer and travel junkie, Jason Moore.
Hey there, it's Jason with ZeroToTravel.com. Welcome to the show, my friend. Thank you so much for letting me bring a little travel into your ears today and spending a little time with me here. This is the show to help you travel the world on your terms, to fill your life with as much travel as you desire, no matter what your situation or experience. You heard all the stuff that I mentioned at the top of the show. That and so much more is coming your way in this special interview, almost 2 hours long, about an hour and 45 minutes it ran. And we just had an absolute blast getting to sit down over a beer in person and talk to somebody who is the only person to travel to every country in the world twice. Was an absolute treat. And I know you're going to dig listening in on our conversation. I gave you some teasers in the beginning. I don't want to spoil any more of it because it's coming at you right now, in just a moment. Before we get into it, I want to quickly thank Tortuga Backpacks for supporting today's show. If you go to zerototravel.com/Tortuga, you are going to get access to a small list of all of their backpacks that I recommend, the few backpacks I recommend and some of the travel gear. And you get 10% off just by using the promo code TRAVEL when you check out. When you check out, you just type in the word TRAVEL. You'll get 10% off any of the things you order over at TortugaBackpacks.com. So again, that link, ZeroToTravel.com/Tortuga. If you go through that link, you'll be supporting this show. Can't say enough good things about these packs. I use them every day in my life. To give you an example, the Tortuga Outbreaker Day Pack, it's the dream day pack for me. It's got the right packability, durability, the material keeps everything dry inside, but you can pack it up and bring it with you and stick it in your bag. It's very minimal and light, but at the same time, when you take it out, it has support, and it's not one of these flimsy day packs that just packs really down, and then you put it on, you've got, I can't carry this thing around all day. These straps are killing me. This is all weighted weird. No, this is so well-constructed, but light that it's something I use all the time in my regular life, day-to-day life, but then when I want to travel, I can just roll it up, pack it in, And usually that goes into my Tortuga Outbreaker when I'm traveling, which is a great 1-2 combo if you're looking for the perfect setup for 3 weeks, 3 months, or 3 years of travel or more. The Outbreakers there, the day pack and the regular Outbreaker, such a great combo. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. There's other packs that I use of theirs. Again, you can see them all through that link. Thanks to them for supporting the show, and thanks to you. If you decide to pick anything up, you'll also be supporting the podcast. Check them out. All right. I don't want to delay this any further. This interview, again, did take place in a bar around the corner. So you might hear some people talking in the background just slightly. We did our best to kind of cut that out. But hey, it's a travel podcast. You get the ambient travel atmosphere. Here's me sitting down with the only person to travel to every country in the world twice. In person, we chatted, so we got to sit down and do this over a beer. I hope you enjoy our conversation, and I will see you on the other side, my friends. I'm always excited when I get to sit down with a beer and talk travel with a fellow traveler, but today I'm especially fired up because I'm sitting here in Oslo, Norway, with the first and only person to travel to every country in the world twice. Yes, two times. He's also the author of a forthcoming book called Elsewhere, Trips to the World's Least Visited Countries. We're going to chat about some of those countries and which ones you might want to consider visiting, plus plenty more around the topic of travel right now. Gunnar Gardfors, welcome to the Zero to Travel podcast, my friend.
Well, thank you very much, Jason. It's lovely to be here in my home country. I'm actually around. That doesn't happen very often.
This is such a treat, man. And you actually bought me the beer, so even double lucky for me.
Well, there you go. Cheers. Or skull, as we say here
in
Norway.
Skull. We're going to do a skull right now.
Yeah, let us.
I mean, might as well. We're here. We're in person. So you told me to call you Gunnar. I had to go with the Norwegian pronunciation, though, just to prove to everybody that I can speak a little bit of Norwegian.
Oh, you're good. Yeah,
and I'm
yeah.
not full of it. I'm not totally full of it.
Well, I'd say you're like 40% or so. You're doing very well.
So you had to get around to every country twice. Like, once wasn't really enough, man. Come on.
Well,
like,
you know, if you look at it.
It seems like a bit, right? This monumental feat. And it's like, you know what? I'm just going to do it again.
Well, I don't know. If you look at it, you know, I realized, because like, when I was doing the book you're talking about, when I was researching it, obviously I had to go back to these 20 countries I'm essentially writing about to do proper research and find out why they're least visited, interview interesting people and all the rest of it. And then I realized that no country in the world deserves to be visited only once.
Right.
And then I just said, ah, shit, I'm going to have to do all of them again. And also for comparative reasons, you know, if I'm going to write a book about the 20 least visited countries, and then I haven't been, and I've been to them twice, and then I haven't been to all the others twice, is that, no, I have to do it. That was my excuse.
Yeah, does something click in you? Like, it seems like you, well, we're going to talk about some of the travel records you have and different things, but a term that I use and other people have used is like this idea of a quest, right? Mm. Like, you have kind of a framework for your travels, right? Instead of just saying, oh, I'm going to wander the world and just, you know, maybe come back and work and then go to these places, you're kind of setting yourself up for like this mission, essentially.
Yeah.
Is it something in your personality or like what is it about like having this type of mission around your travel?
No, it's a good question. Yeah, it's also a quest, and it started many, many years ago, I think, back in 2004. It was one of my brothers. I had three brothers and three sisters. One of them is called Einstein. I'm the oldest. He's the second oldest. And we were reading the local newspaper in middle of nowhere, or Norway, right. You know, whichever you
middle
prefer.
Of nowhere, you mean where you're from?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Yeah, small village where
How
I'm
many
from.
How many people are in that town?
Well, in the center, around 1,000.
Okay, yeah, and it's on the West Coast.
It's on the West
Beautiful
Coast.
Beautiful area.
It is. It's amazing. I really would miss it where, you know, I live here in Oslo, just like you do, and I do miss the mountains and the fjords and the glaciers and the waterfalls and all the rest of it. But we were reading the local newspaper, you know, print five or whatever, five copies, right. Maybe 5,000.
Right.
And we're reading about some people that were here in Norway to do research, some engineers to do research on hydropower. You know, we have all these waterfalls and we're really good at hydropower,
right.
You know, which is environmentally friendly and all the rest of it. And they were from Kyrgyzstan, you know, to do research. And we said, Kyrgyzstan. And we started researching it and we discovered, oh, that's actually a country in Central Asia.
Okay.
So we traveled there and we were so fascinated.
Wait a minute.
This was in 2004.
So we traveled there. Because it seems like there's a gap there because you guys had to go through like a decision-making process. You're like, you just read this article in the paper. You're like, we've never heard of that, so we're just going to go.
Yeah, well,
like,
well,
how long did it take? Did you guys just make the decision literally right there?
No, it was sort of lucky because, well, he's a teacher, so he has what we call here awesome holiday.
Yeah.
It's every awesome in October. They have 1 week off, the kids and the teachers. And, well, where I worked, and I still work at Norwegian Broadcasting Corporation as a journalist, I'm pretty flexible when it comes to holiday. So, so we're talking, well, let's go on holiday together. We're really good friends and as well as brothers. But let's not go somewhere normal, we were saying 15 years ago.
Right.
And that's when we read the article, which fit, you know, it fit really nicely into it. So yeah, that's very normal. Like, is that even a country?
Don't know anybody that's been here. Let's go.
Let's go. And then we started researching ticket prices, and they're extremely expensive, as you can imagine, from middle of nowhere, Oslo, nowhere, Naustdal, wherever.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, shit, that's going to cost us too much money. And I said, oh, well, maybe we'll go to France after all. And then I returned to work because this was before smartphones. So I didn't check my emails every 4 minutes. So I came back to Oslo for work, and I checked my laptop. And in my emails, there was an invitation to do a speech about new media in Kazakhstan, which is a neighboring country to Kyrgyzstan.
Really?
And of course,
that's not a sign. I don't know what is.
No, I don't know exactly. You know, yeah. So you see, and of course, then my tickets would be paid for, and my accommodation and all the rest of it. So I just called my brother immediately. And
you're like, you have to pay for yours.
Yeah, but and by coincidence, it was the same week when he was having his awesome holiday.
No kidding.
I called my brother Einstein. I said, you're not going to leave this, but we're going to bloody Kyrgyzstan. And I explained, and he said, what? And, so we traveled there, a couple of months later.
Yeah.
And we were so well received. Hospitality out of this world. No tourists. Amazing nature, scenery, very high mountains, over 7,000 meters. And, lovely food. It was incredible.
Wow.
So then after this holiday, we visited Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan, two out of seven stan countries. As a matter of fact, I decided I'm going to have to visit all the stan countries.
Yeah.
And, for...
You got Stan fever.
I still have Stan fever.
Yeah. There are nice places I haven't been to.
Well,
any of them,
you're certainly missing out, you know.
So, well, we're going to talk about some of these least visited destinations, but...
Well, the thing is that very few, only one of the Stan countries... Well, no, that's true. That's not true. Two of the Stan countries are on the list of the least visited countries in the world. So, but yeah, highly, highly recommended. And then 4 years later, in 2008... I sort of run out of Stan countries. So I said, I need another goal. And then I decided to visit every country in the world. And I finished that in 2013. That was sort of a quest. And then for the second time, I guess, that was also some sort of a quest.
Yeah.
Although it tied into the book research.
Well, when you kind of decided that, was it mindset-wise, were you just, this is what I'm doing and like there's no stopping me? Or were you having doubts, or did you just kind of make a decision and then you're just like, this is what I'm doing. I'm going for it. This is my life. Cause you're working, like you said, you're working a full time job and you weren't doing this full time, right?
I wasn't. And so I was doing this while working full time.
Right.
And in Norway, we're lucky. We have 7 weeks of holiday. If you count sort of religious holidays and bank holidays and all the rest of it.
Religious holidays here for a non-religious country. It's like, wait, my wife keeps telling me, it's off. We're off Monday. We're off on Friday. I'm like, what do you mean? I don't understand. We're off for what?
Isn't it great? I mean, I love
fantastic.
It.
Fantastic.
Yeah. And you don't really know why, but I'll take it.
Yeah.
You know, it's good. And of course, then, I don't accept overtime pay where I work, Norwegian Broadcasting Corporation. I said, well, I'd rather take time off.
Right.
So I save up hours. And so then typically on Wednesday, I would leave work, a little bit early, go to the airport, fly somewhere exciting. I'd land Thursday morning. I'd spend the long weekend there. I'd leave again Sunday evening. I'd land in Oslo Monday morning, go home, have a shower, and go to work,
Yeah.
So by doing that, I could, I could maximize the little time I had off in addition to the 7 weeks of holiday.
So it was a combination of you going on long, like, weekend trips or whatever, and then taking your extended holiday, and just, what would you do, take a big chunk of it? And just go to a bunch of places?
Typically, and go to several places. Yeah. And also through my line of work, as I said, originally journalist, but now I work more with administrative stuff and radio distribution and more technical stuff. and which means I'm presenting in loads of different conferences, whether it's in Kazakhstan or it's in South Africa.
So you get paid to travel to some of these places.
Suddenly I'm in, you know, let's say I'm at a conference in South Africa. So, you know, that's typically a 3-, 4-, 5-day conference, which means it's more or less the entire week when you have to travel all the way there. So instead of traveling on the Monday or the Sunday, I would travel, let's say, on the Thursday or the Friday, which means I have a weekend there. And then I, you know, and it's paid for, you know, my tickets are paid for.
Right.
And then I'll pay a little bit extra and I'll fly somewhere nearby, typically like Botswana or Lesotho or the Maldives or, you know, Mauritius or somewhere.
Yeah.
Then I'll go to the conference and then I'll do the same the second weekend. I'll travel somewhere else, you know, Zimbabwe, Mozambique, you know, Swaziland, wherever.
Yeah.
So in that way, you know, I don't have to pay for the expensive tickets all the way to South Africa.
Right.
I only pay for the short ones, you know, nearby.
You were chipping away.
I was chipping away. Yeah. No, it was a bonus. And, you know.
It's cool. It's the working man's every country visitor, right?
Like, well, you know, I wish. But yeah, so I think I've worked in 25 countries.
Yeah.
I've been to 25 countries of work, but, you know.
Yeah, no, but I mean, just that you've been working this entire time. You haven't, like, you know, inherited a bunch of money and gone and seen every country in the world taking years off or whatever.
That sounds nice, actually.
It does sound pretty nice.
Can you have an uncle, a rich uncle I can borrow? You know?
Oh, yeah, that's the big joke in America, right? Or in Norway, the rich uncle in America.
Oh, absolutely.
Isn't that the...
No, no one has a rich uncle, but there's this myth that someone has a rich uncle. But,
well,
you know.
It's funny because I have nieces on my wife's side, so I'm their uncle. And I said, can I be the rich uncle from America? Can I actually be the rich uncle from America? Not yet. But,
and that's really the stereotype, because the rich uncle, it should be from America.
Right.
That's it.
That's the Norwegian stereotype, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So you totally fit the bill. You just have to become rich, I guess.
Except for the rich part, unfortunately.
Well, you know.
All right. So Kurdistan kind of kicked things off, but were you traveling a bunch before then? You mentioned for work, but had you done any... Were there any travel experiences early on that kind of made a big impact on you personally?
Indirectly, because when I was 4 years old, my brother Øystein, he was 2, and we were the only ones who were born back then. This was in 1979. Yeah. My father, he's a retired medical doctor now, but he was a medical doctor back then, and he was working on a cruise ship in the Pacific.
Another great way to get paid to travel.
Well,
right?
Absolutely, you know, and
as a medical doctor,
yeah. So he was the cruise ship doctor or the ship doctor, whatever they call them. And
how long would he be gone for?
Well, he only did this once for I think 9 or 12 months.
Okay, yeah.
And I don't know, slightly selfishly maybe to leave wife and 2 kids back home in Norway. You know, while he was cruising the Pacific. Nevertheless, that's what happened. Good life experience.
You know,
my mom visited on once or twice.
Sure.
And she got the good, you got a bit
still
of the,
gotta live
the
your
nice
life.
Life.
Right? Yeah. Sending the money back home.
Yeah. But the thing was that, of course, we can read when, you know, I was 4 and he was 2, we can read. So what my dad did, he was recording on old-fashioned cassette tapes, audio cassette tapes, these incredible tales from the Philippines, from China, from Japan, from Alaska, from Canada.
That's so cool.
He sent them home twice a month in these, I don't know if you remember these, par avion, like airmail envelopes.
Yeah.
And, you know, we ran down to the mailbox 100 meters from our home on the west coast of Norway, you know, every day to see, is there going to be another audio cassette tape?
Yeah.
And
you're getting stories from all over the world to your mailbox.
It was
from your dad.
Wow. In 1979, there was no internet, no smartphones, no nothing.
It's incredible now. Like, it's just still a beautiful thing. It really is.
And, I just remember that when I was 4 and I told my mom, when I become as big as my dad, then I also want to travel to a lot of countries.
Right, yeah.
So this made a tremendous impact on little Gunnar back in 1979. And, you know, so I think that was what kickstarted it, not me traveling, but my dad doing it sort of on my behalf and telling stories about it.
Do you still have the tapes? Have you listened to
my
them?
My mom has some of them, and I listened to some of them. And the funny bit, you know, of course, it's interesting to hear my dad tell these stories again, but the funny bit was that my brother and me, we obviously thought we had to do the same thing. Then again, we didn't have much to tell. So it was sort of like very squeaky voices of very small kids telling our dad about what we did in the play, you know, in the playground and stuff. And I remember, you know, the last cassette tape I listened to was, you know, I was talking about my brother. He was trying to lift a very, very, very big and heavy rock, but he couldn't quite make it. So I helped him, and then we managed, you know. So the stories we told were probably not as exciting as as the stories my dad told us, but, you know, we tried.
Do you remember one of the stories that he shared with you? I was just trying to get a sense of what type of stuff he was sharing with you.
Yeah, from China. You know, he was in the Forbidden City in Beijing, and he also told us about life on the river, on the big yellow river, where people didn't have engines on their boats. They were having these big, what do you call them, big sticks, and they're sort of pushing the boat forward.
Yeah.
And this was like, wow, you know, you couldn't really picture it. Well, of course, we pictured it somehow.
Right.
But that made such an impact, you know, stories like that.
Yeah.
And the Forbidden City was like, no, it's forbidden. What do you mean? But it's a city. No, but it's... and then he told about the emperors and all the rest of it and tried to explain it. So he always put it into some sort of a context. He's really good. His tales are well told, let's say, you know. And our mom was there listening in as well. Of course, he also wrote a letter for her. I don't know what he wrote.
Yeah. You didn't listen to those tapes.
we didn't read it.
That could have traumatized your childhood and changed everything differently. That's funny.
But she was there to answer questions and everything. So when we ask, you know, if there's something he didn't tell us, you know, so why is it the city forbidden or whatever, she was always there and, you know, provided context. So it was brilliant.
No, it is a beautiful thing, really. I mean, when you think about it, and I mean, I just picturing you guys, because I come from... we're about the same age, and I mean, I used to make mixtapes, and you know, tapes were a thing for sure. But just picturing you guys running out to the mailbox in your small town, your small village, getting that tape, like putting it in, being so excited, what's it going to say? And there's something really special about audio, I think, too, because you just mentioned it. It's like, well, you know, we couldn't picture it, but you have to picture it, right? When it's audio, you're forced to picture it, and you get to hear the ambient audio of wherever he was recording. And you get to be with that person who's your father.
Indeed, yeah. It was
across the world somewhere. It's, I can imagine, I mean, I can see why it was so impactful, I guess. And what a cool thing to do. Like,
It was really inspiring.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I like to believe that's what really kickstarted it. It's difficult to say. It was when I was 4 years old and everything.
No, but clearly,
it left an impression with me, you know, which still is here today.
Yeah. So. I mean, it's too easy with email now, right?
No audio with emails or audio.
You just make audio and you're just like, oh, just email to this person and now they have it. Here you go.
Exactly.
All right. So you and your brother went to one of the stands, then you started knocking off the stands, and then you're knocking off these countries and you're committed to traveling to every country in the world. At some point, it seems like just from the rating I've done on you that I don't know when this was in your sort of story arc of your life, but you started getting into... breaking some travel records and different things.
Yeah.
And you have a really healthy attitude about this, actually, because I was reading about it. I was like, what is the motivation here? And I just wanted to hear, I want you to share some of them first and we can talk about
that. Yeah, it started in 2012. I was actually in 2011, I think. I was in Turkey. I was in Istanbul. And as you know, there's the biggest city in Turkey, one of the biggest in Europe.
This is sort of because 2013, you completed your first...
Yeah.
All countries. So this is like about a year.
It was just a year and a half. Yeah, a little over a year. Less than a year, actually, before I completed.
Okay, yeah.
But I was in Istanbul. And then, as you know, Istanbul is divided between two continents, Europe and Asia. And I was driving, I was taking a minibus from the European part of Istanbul to the Asian part. And you cross the bridge and you're on the other side in 2 minutes. Or maybe in 1 minute and a half, whatever. And I was like, wow, I've been to two continents in 2 minutes. I wonder how many continents is it possible to visit in one day? And this was the thing that got me started. And I started, you know, searching for plane tickets and, you know, finding itineraries and how can this be done? And then I figured a way to do it. And I said, well, you know, this is only a theory. It has to be proven. Just like in physics class in school, right?
Right.
And then I called one of my friends, Adrian Butterworth, who I studied with in England. And I said, hey, Adrian, are you up for a little bit of a crazy trip? You know, no one has ever done this before. We're going to visit five continents in one day.
And how do you know nobody's done? I mean, do you look up the Guinness records and different things?
Didn't exist. There was nothing there. And we applied to get the record acknowledged by Guinness, and it was like 3 years later or something. It took quite a long time.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think they were sort of thinking, should we really make something as crazy as this a world record? And in the end, they said, okay, let's do it.
Yeah. So it was, what was the record again?
That was the highest number of continents visited in one calendar day.
Okay, 24 hours.
Yeah. Well, no, that's actually not the case, because we're cheating a little bit. Of course, we were traveling westwards.
Right.
So the time was helping us a bit. Okay. So I think it took us 28 hours and 21 minutes or something. But it was all on June 12 in 2012. And so we left. We started in Istanbul, but we didn't want to do two continents in one country.
Yeah.
So we didn't do Europe, Istanbul, and then Asia, Istanbul. We started in the Asian part of Istanbul. We flew to Africa, Casablanca, Morocco. Then we flew to Paris, Europe. You know, it's another country. And then we flew to the Dominican Republic in North America, and then to Caracas, Venezuela in South America. So we sort of wanted to do it properly. We didn't sort of want to sort of cheat, you know,
right,
by doing Europe and Asia in Turkey.
Yeah,
so it was five countries in five continents in one day.
Wow.
So that was, it was such a nice thing to do with one of my best mates.
Right.
When on the way back, we stayed much longer in each country.
Because
he was making a documentary about it, so we needed some more footage and all the rest of it. And of course, we wanted to experience the countries instead of just racing through them. So it was a fabulous holiday.
Yeah, it was. I can imagine you guys giggling a lot and just kind of like, oh, I can't believe we're doing this. This is crazy. Like, were you boosting it up on the plane? I mean, why were you passing the time?
Well, we were sleeping lots of the time. Chatting.
Just 28 hours of travel.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It was a Monday. It was a very long one.
Right. That's a long travel day.
It was, yes.
Yeah, because you've said these are more, quote, logistics records than travel records.
Indeed, yeah. I don't really consider this travel. It's more logistics, as you say. It's all about getting from A to B and then to C and D and E and F and whatever as fast as you can. And you don't really get to meet people. You don't get to experience anything or very little. But at the same time, it's sort of it gives you an adrenaline rush to do something that no one's ever done before.
Right.
And if you do it with one of your best friends, it's even better. So it's sort of the ultimate boys trip. And of course, you celebrate afterwards and then you do some proper traveling. But yeah, definitely this is nothing or very little to do about traveling. And, you know, we also did 19 countries in 24 hours around Europe. And I would never count those visits in those 24 hours as having been or visited that country, you know, for any other purpose than breaking world record.
Right.
So, you know, I never counted those as having been to that country. That would be totally wrong, in my opinion.
Gotcha. I mean, so what do you define as proper traveling for yourself? And this is different for everybody, of course.
It's different from everyone. And some people, they count airport stops. Some people even count fuel stops inside an airplane, you know, because technically they've been on the ground, sort of, even about 5-6 meters above the ground. But
wrong.
Well, I do agree with you. Yeah.
I'm not kidding, because they are. Sorry.
Well, come on. No, to me, it's about...
Fuel stop? Come on.
Yeah, I know. That's a little bit too much. And even airport stops. I mean, whatever floats your boat. No. But, you know, to me, travel is about experiencing places and people, meeting people, trying their foods, seeing their sceneries, you know, exploring their cities or villages or
getting a sense of the place.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Having a taste of it.
Which is subjective, of course. But
well, that's very true. But I mean, if you don't speak to anybody, and unfortunately, most of us as in Western people traveling the world, we travel with other Western people, which means we don't really talk a lot to locals because, hey, we're already having a good time with our mates or our wife or our boyfriend or whoever from home. Which is, it's a shame, in my opinion, because, you know, you don't meet anybody. You might even stay in a Western hotel, Marriott's or Westin or one of those, Sheraton. Yeah. And then even the hotel, the money you pay the hotel, they don't even go to the local economy. They don't benefit the local economy. You stay in a hotel with a bunch of other Westerners, and you don't really participate in what locals do. People working in reception that might even be foreigners because they're cheaper to employ. So I think there's a lot of, what should I say, wrong or bad about the way a lot of us travel.
Yeah.
You know, it's about seeking experiences, meeting the locals, asking them questions, you know. And the moment you do that, you know, you start engaging, they invite you to weddings or dinners or hidden beaches or hikes or you name it, on, you know, and rides with horses or cars or whatever. Yeah. And you get a real sense of the place, the town, the village, the country, whatever. If you don't do that, you know, and then you say, well, I've been to every country in the world or I've been to that and that country and say, yeah, but what did you do? I was like, oh, next question, please. Like, come on. Yeah. So in my opinion, well, I've stayed a week on average in every country, all 198 countries in the world. I've stayed overnight in every country as well. Even the only hotel-less country in the world, the Vatican.
Right. Wow.
No
yeah.
hotels there.
Yeah. So where did you sleep there?
Well, on the ground. Yeah. It was very, very cold. Yeah. But I did sort of borrow a blanket from Scandinavian Airlines.
Yeah. One of those
I did return it. Really thick,
well, warm blankets.
Yeah, exactly. I was freezing my butt off there. And I got really friendly with the Swiss guard because they were like, what the hell are you doing here?
Right.
I was like, well, you're shivering, dude. And I said, like, yeah, well, yes, it's very cold.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, so I was allowed to stay there, you know, so I didn't break the law or anything, but it was very cold.
I mean, yeah, I think, spending a night, at least a night, when I was traveling the States, I always said, I can't count the state. If I was just passing through, I have to spend a night there.
Yeah.
Spend a night there.
Yeah, yeah, and I do agree.
Sorry. I do agree. Hair on my microphone.
That's awful. Whose hair is it?
I don't know. I hope it's mine.
Yeah,
or maybe
well,
not.
Hopefully not mine. You know.
You mentioned meeting locals, and obviously that being a huge part of travel and being able to get underneath into the skin of a place, really. And having traveled so much, I'm just wondering what some of your advices or maybe just tips or maybe just share some of your experiences around meeting locals. Like how would you talk to the traveler that's just getting started with their world travels, or maybe they've been traveling in a certain style, they've been traveling for business, and now they're like, hey, I want to have more encounters with locals. I want to do that, my travels, in a different way. How do you make those connections on the ground?
Well, if you travel for business, you have to set aside some time, maybe a weekend, like I was talking about earlier. You know, you take maybe two weekends even if you're able to do so, but at least one extra day. Dress down, don't wear your business attire, and then just walk. The moment you take taxis everywhere, you don't really meet many people. You meet a taxi driver, perhaps, you know, if he or she is talkative. But yeah, talk to people. And just, you know, and if you're a little bit shy, and I'm Norwegian, so I'm very shy. Most Norwegians are very, very shy. And people think we're arrogant, and some of us might be, but I'd like to say it's purely due to shyness. But you know, so even if you're shy, you ask somebody, you know, excuse me, could you tell me the time? Or could you tell me the where the train station is, or the museum, or do you know a good restaurant, or whatever? But what we're seeing now is that, let's say, inventions are preventing this. First of all, we travel with Western people, typically, Western friends, colleagues, family, whatever. So we don't really, we stay in Western hotels, so we don't meet local people there. Maybe the receptionist, or maybe the waitress or the waiter, if we're lucky, unless they're from a different country.
Right.
And then you have stuff like Google Maps, and Google Maps is similar map services. They're brilliant, but they are preventing us from actually asking people on the streets, could you recommend a restaurant? You know, so they're taking away that opportunity from us.
Yeah.
Then you have selfie sticks, which means that instead of asking somebody, could you please take my photograph? We're just doing it ourselves.
Right.
I'm not saying, you know, slagging off selfie sticks, although they look pretty stupid, I must admit. But, you know, if people want to use selfie sticks, you know, so be it. But, you know, these technical so-called inventions are, you know, removing us away from locals.
Yeah.
And that's a bad thing, I think.
Yeah.
And then you have guidebooks. I think the biggest insult, so don't do this, never read a guidebook in front of locals. You know, let's say you were sitting here in this bar in Norway and you're reading Lonely Planet Norway.
Right.
And I'm sitting next to you.
Right.
That's sort of an insult. Why don't you ask me?
Yeah.
Come on, Justin, come on. Do I look that, you know, ugly? Is my personal hygiene that bad? Come on. This guidebook was
written. The guidebook will tell you if your personal hygiene's that bad.
Yeah, exactly. This was probably written by a foreigner, meaning not a Norwegian, not a local.
Right.
Maybe 2 years ago, maybe 5 years ago, maybe last year. Mm. But you know, he or she was probably here for only a few days or a week at the best, or maybe 2 weeks. And it depends on his or her interest and all the rest of it. Instead, you should ask someone who's clearly up to date because they live in the village or the city or the country.
Yeah.
So these sorts of, let's say, modern...
conveniences.
Conveniences. Yeah. You know, removing the pleasure of the
right.
travel.
Yeah, there is certainly the convenience factor of, oh, okay, well, I just want to go to a cafe now and I'm lost, so I'm just going to pull up my Google Maps. But is it important to get there quicker, or is it important to have some kind of interaction that you wouldn't have had? You know what I mean? It's...
Well, when
these are important things to ask yourself, I think, before you travel. What is my relationship with technology? This is something I've been talking about a lot lately. Like, and should you even consider putting up some rules around it? Or, I mean, when you're traveling, do you set up? You mentioned, we made a joke earlier about, like, oh, this is before, like, smartphones. I didn't check my email every 4 minutes or whatever. Yeah. I mean, do you set up rules for yourself around technology and those sorts of things when you're traveling? Or is it just you just go into travel mode and you're just like, all right, I'm on the road now. Like, I just talked to everybody and this is what I do.
Well, of course, it depends. Sometimes you're in a hurry.
Hungry. I mean, we're talking about generally speaking.
I want to talk to people, you know, because that's where you find the beautiful stories. That's where you really discover the soul of the country.
Yeah.
You know, that's when you are introduced to the real country, not just the surface. It's about, to me, it's about participation. If you don't talk to people, you're only, in my opinion, only an observer.
Yeah.
And it might get you millions or thousands of likes on Instagram or Facebook or wherever you post your stuff. But hey, come on, you haven't really spoken to anybody. You don't really get their pulse. You don't get under their skin. And if you don't do that, then really what's the point of travel?
Right.
I mean, yeah, bragging rights, perhaps, but it's the same as, you know, not the same, but it's a little bit the same as landing for a refueling stop in an airplane. It's like, oh, I've been to that country. Of course, you know, if you see it, it's much better than not traveling at all, in my opinion.
Yeah.
But if you don't engage, you lose out on so much.
The observer role is interesting because that, no matter how much you engage, there's still an element of that as a traveler, right? And I can think of myself first coming to Norway and not knowing any of the language and just sitting at dinner with my in-laws and not being able to engage because they're all speaking in Norwegian.
Yeah.
And I'm just forced into the observer role, right? Or you're watching a parade or something in some foreign country. Just, you know, you're observing, like, you don't really know how to participate. You know, you don't want to do anything that's going to offend anybody or, you know, there's these certain situations. So it's interesting because there's that element of it, but then also you need to engage too, right? You don't need to, but certainly I think we're on the same page there. You want to get to know people.
Yeah.
Like,
and it will most likely elevate your experience by far. And I mean, of course, we're all observers at times,
right?
Even at home or whenever we travel, you know, we can't participate in everything, you know, but it's something about thriving, you know, looking for opportunities to actually engage.
Well, what are some of the standout experiences with locals that you've had through all your travels? I mean, can you think of an example that sort of exemplifies, like, what you said before, which I thought was really well put, saying it was, you know, really lets you in on the soul of the country?
Well, it's something, there are so many experiences. Maybe one in Yemen. I was there last year. It's a war-ridden country. It's also the least visited country in the world, with only 60 tourists a year. Or five tourists
Yemen?
A month. Yemen.
Yeah.
It's war-ridden. It's a disaster there, a humanitarian disaster. It's really, really bad. Loads of kids are starving, not enough food. You know, there are warplanes from neighboring countries and all the rest of it. And then I visited, you know, met this mango farmer on the outskirts of Aden, the city in the south.
How did you end up out there?
Well, traveling to Yemen, as I said, is not the safest place to go. So I contacted a fixer, one of these persons that help typically journalists and aid workers and everything, and similar people
get through
the country safely. And so I asked him, so, you know, who do you recommend we go? You know, I would like to meet someone outside Aden, outside the city.
To some people.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah, I want to talk to some, you know. And he said, do you know any, like, farmers or fishermen or whatever? And he took me to a fisherman, but he also took me to this mango farmer.
Oh, just asking. Yeah.
Yeah. So I just said, yeah, come on, who do you recommend? And and he didn't know him himself, but he heard about him. He had 70 mango trees, and he was making a living out of that. Hmm. And I was there with my American for the photographer, Lexi Alford. She just made history now. She's now the youngest person in the world at 21 that's visited every country in the world.
Oh.
Just as of a
few weeks
ago.
Photographer?
She was my photographer to Yemen.
Read about her.
Oh, yeah.
That's so
only,
funny.
Only to Yemen. So she small actually photographed. World. It's a small world, indeed. Yeah. So she actually photographed the cover to my book, my last book.
Oh, really? Okay.
Which is neat. It's a little bit of a side story, I guess. But yeah, she was there. And we were invited into this farmer's house, you know, for dinner. We're just going to, you know, talk to him, see his mango trees. And didn't want to disturb him too much. But, you know, he was so thrilled that we came all the way from, you know, the United States and Norway to visit his little farm.
Yeah.
But in Yemen, it's a very patriarchal society. So me, as a foreign man, or as a man overall, not in his family, I was not allowed to meet his wife. But she cooked the most incredible meal, I've ever had, but one of the most incredible meals I've ever had, like a four-course, you know, meal. And it was all served by his sons, because the wife was not allowed to come into the living room. We're sitting on the floor. There's no furniture there, except a tiny little brown desk with a tiny television on it. No sofas, no tables, no nothing.
Really?
And they were sitting on the floor eating and chatting, and it was such a nice gesture. And he doesn't have, or him and his family doesn't have much more money.
Right.
But it's all about, wow, these people are coming to my country. That's incredible. I really want to give them something in return. I want to get to know them. I want to talk to them. And he didn't speak English. So, you know, through the fixer, he was interpreting, you know, as well.
What was the conversation about?
It was about everything. I asked him about global warming, for instance. You know, he was really struggling because there was almost no rain anymore. And he told me when this started happening, and it's the number of mangoes declined every year. He had a pump, pump running on petrol or diesel, that was pumping water up from a well. But you know, this pump would go; it would become hot after, you know, only 2 hours. You know, he was really struggling.
Yeah.
Also talking about, you know, him traveling. Of course, he'd never been outside Yemen, so his notion of traveling was going to Aden, the nearest city, or Sana'a, the capital, which is further away, right, where he hadn't been for years because of the war there. So it was really interesting to talk to him about, and also his sons. There were three of his sons there, a couple of his nephews, and you know, they're all men sitting there, and I was, you know, I was saying to the interpreter, the fixer, that, oh, no, come on, this is, we don't want to eat their food and everything. They don't have too much. And then one of the sons, he said, I swear on my grandmother's grave that you will have dinner with us. and so we sort of realized that, no, there's like, no way we can run away from it. No, that was not. So we said, okay, fair enough. And of course, it was magnificent. It was such a magical experience to sit there and share stories and to be served this. Wow, it was so delicious, the food there. You know, I can still taste it, you know.
Those are the best travel experiences, I think.
Yeah.
When you're getting invited to somebody's home for...
And then we asked him, you know, after we ended up staying there, I don't know, 3 hours or so.
Yeah.
And then he walks us to the car, and he says that, you should meet my neighbor. He's got 28 sons and approximately 12 daughters. And he says something about the society. He knows exactly how many sons he's got. Daughters, not so important. And it really sort of, you know, 28 sons, approximately 12 daughters.
Yeah.
And it turned out he didn't know this, but it turned out this guy, he died the week before and he didn't know this. So we never met this person. And I just hope all these, 40 or so kids were with different women. You know, I really hope one woman didn't have to go through 40 births. But
oh my gosh.
I don't know. I never got to meet them, so I wouldn't know.
Do you have any kids or...
I don't have any kids. No. I'm the oldest of six, oldest of seven. So I have six siblings, and so I've changed diapers. I've made, you know, dinner and all that stuff.
Yeah,
you know.
You've done it, right?
So I'm sort of, I don't have this urge to have children. Yeah.
You know what that is.
I know what that is. Yeah.
It's funny you say that because we were just hanging out with my nieces here in Norway this weekend, and the oldest one kept getting stuck with kind of watching over everybody.
Ah, right,
and it was just a casual kind of, like everybody's going outside. Can you Sigrid, can you just, you know, make sure everybody's okay?
No.
And it's not like, I mean, it's totally normal, but I guess in as the oldest, you just slip into that role,
yeah,
right?
I think so, yeah. So I remember, you know, when I was a kid, my three younger sisters, I had to walk them in one, what do you call it, push chair.
Yeah.
So one of the youngest was sitting in the push chair and the other two were sort of hanging onto it. And we, you know, I had to, I had to look after them because my mom, she had to go to some meetings, whatever. And I had to pass the football field where all my friends were playing football or soccer.
Yeah.
In your case,
yeah.
And I was like, ah, dude, mom, you hate me so much, you know. But now, you know, there are seven of us. It's such a great experience. You know, we get together as often as we can, and you know, share experiences. And I'm now the uncle of was it? Eight, almost nine. Nine in July, yes.
Congrats. That's awesome. Well, you started chatting about Yemen. I'll let you have a sip of your ol there.
Very nice.
And got us onto the least visited countries, which is, of course, the subject of your book. And that was the least visited, right? And I want to talk about some of these countries, but can you just share with everybody how you determined that list? Because it's actually based on some statistics and Fed. You didn't just willy-nilly say, hey, nobody goes to these countries. I'm just going to write down these 20 and we'll call it a day.
Yeah.
Talk about how you formulated this list.
Yeah. Well, the United Nations, they have an organization called the World Tourism Organization, so UNWTO. They have a list over tourist numbers to every country in the world, except they're lacking the least visited countries because they don't have any tourist authority or
infrastructure that's happening. So there's nothing to report.
No, exactly.
Yeah.
Or it doesn't exist. They don't, you know, they're not going to spend any money on that kind of stuff. You know, it might be war-ridden countries and so on.
Right.
So what I did, I used the UN list for the countries with numbers on it, with figures on the list. And then I had to go to every country without numbers, without figures, and do research on my own. So I spoke to immigration officers. I spoke to prime ministers. I spoke to culture ministers, tourism ministers, hoteliers, and all the rest of it. So I really had to find these figures. I spoke in Tuvalu. They are actually on the list, but it turned out the figures, Tuvalu is an island country in the Pacific, as you know, but some of your listeners might not know. And it turned out their numbers were inaccurate. So I went to the Statistical Bureau of Tuvalu, and I found out the reported numbers of 2,000 tourists included every business person as well. So the real number of tourists were 800, which makes it the fourth least visited country in the world.
Hmm.
So in some cases, and also in Eritrea, the numbers they reported officially turned out to be false or wrong.
Yeah. How do those numbers come together? How do they figure? How do you get to that number?
How did I get this?
No, how do they get to that? Like, yeah, I mean, it just seems so.
Well, they have most countries have tourism authorities. And
yeah,
they,
I mean, I guess the immigration, yeah, they check everybody that's coming in. Yeah. So it's.
But of course, some countries like Tuvalu, you have to fill out this report
or visas
or whatever.
Yeah.
So they have a very accurate number of foreigners visiting the country. But then you have Europe, the Schengen area, for instance. You don't have to show your passport.
Right.
So you don't really know exactly how many visitors you have.
But you know it's not in the least visited list.
Well, that's very true. So, but they still provide numbers, so these numbers must be estimates.
Right.
Which means, even the UNWTO list, it's not 100% accurate.
Right.
And then you have to ask yourself, what is a tourist? So what if I visit, let's say, South Africa for a conference, but then I spend the weekend there?
Yeah, like what
am
you
I
did.
Then the, yeah, exactly. Am I then a tourist or am I a business visitor and so on and so forth? So there are always going to be gray zones here anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
for sure.
I think it's impossible, unless you are God, to make this list very accurate. Accurately.
Yeah, but that means it sounds like you made it as accurate as you can.
I think so, yes. Yeah. And it's a first complete list of all 198 countries in the world in literature history, you know, which is now out in my book. I'm only writing about the 20 least visited countries where I spoke to people and you know, discovered some incredible stories. But every country in the world is actually on the list in the back of the book. So you can look up the United States, which I think is number two on the list, or three on the list.
It's really interesting that...
Of most visited countries, of course.
I mean, this is where your journalistic background comes into play, I guess, right? Did you always want to be a journalist? Or
I did, since we had a journalist visiting our class, grade 5 or something.
Really?
And then I said, wow, I want to be a journalist.
Really?
And I made my first newspaper. There was only one copy of it. And my friend and me, we made it on my dad's typewriter. And we colored the front page on our own. And yeah. then we walked around the neighborhood in Naustdal trying to sell a newspaper for like 20p or so, 20 yeah. cents or something. And in the end, our nearest neighbor bought a copy.
Yeah.
Of course, we didn't want to go to our nearest neighbor first because it was a little bit embarrassing. So we went to all the others and nobody wants to buy it. And then in the end, my nearest neighbor bought the only copy of this newspaper when I was eight or something.
I mean, it seems like so just the logistics of some of the things that you've done. You've talked about the records and getting just geeky with the logistics or putting together this list and having to just go so deep to get these numbers. It must be something you really enjoy, that process of kind of putting that puzzle together.
For sure. And I think it's the same if you're a very eager football fan. You probably know the number on the back of the jersey of every player on your team, and you probably know their height and their weight, you know, their favorite interests, blah yeah. blah, what favorite food, all the rest of it. So, you know, really go into your hobby. And yeah. I guess it's the same with me when it comes to travel.
Yeah,
I really go into it, and I love statistics. I love knowing a little bit about the countries, the places, the towns and villages that I actually visit. And I love to meet people from them in order to feed my appetite for more info and inside information, if you like. You know, if you don't talk to people, you yeah. cannot get inside info.
I think it's great, man. I have a lot of these experiences that I carry with me, but I'm not so good at piecing together sort of like bringing in the history into the stories or like, you know, some of the statistics or things. I think it's fascinating.
It took a lot of research. Yeah. So I purchased books in most countries, some kind of like Nauru, the second least visited country in the world, also in the Pacific. They, you know, there were no books really that I could find. No bookshops, no nothing. And that's quite interesting, actually, because the 20 countries that are on this list, you can group them into two. One is countries that are war-ridden or they've been hit by disaster, terror, lack of food, lack of water.
Yeah.
So, you know, in other words, there are many, many reasons why people don't go there because they're considered dangerous or awful places.
Right.
And then you have the other group, which consists of countries that no one has even heard about. You know, typically islands, little infrastructure, almost no flights. And so on. So, you know, of course, they don't have a tourism agency. They have no marketing dollars to market their country.
Right.
So you can sort of group them in two.
So would you say that the latter, those places are places that you might recommend people to see? Because I'm curious out of this list, which places you would say, oh, like, you're probably not going to say, well, go to Syria right now or whatever. There's a lot of stuff going on. But what are some of the places on the list that you would say, hey, maybe this is a place you should...
Oh, absolutely. I think I have a few favorites there. I would say Sao Tome and Principe, which is an island group. It's off Africa.
Say it again.
Sao Tome and Principe.
Okay.
Which consists of two islands. One is called Sao Tome and the other one is called Principe.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's on the equator. It's west of Gabon in Africa and just south of Nigeria. So it's quite far from the mainland. First time I visited, there was no flights. Because I hadn't checked. It was a poor research on my behalf. But there were no flights due to Easter. And they canceled all the flights. So in the end, I ended up on a cargo ship from Gabon to Sao Tome and Principe. And they told me it's going to take 11, 12 hours. It took 42 hours in the end. And I brought food for like 15, 16 hours.
Right, I was going to say, they're not like, there's no cafeteria you're going
to,
right?
No, not on that cargo ship. And it's very, you know, that's very hard.
This could be karma for the story we were talking about your backpack.
Absolutely.
Earlier.
And my backpack was on the boat. Yeah,
we will recant that at the end of this. All right. So, you know, saying it's going to take this amount of time and it really takes this amount
absolutely.
Of time.
And you have a phrase for that in Africa. It is TIA, which stands for This is Africa, which sort of means what would you really expect? The schedules don't really apply here.
Right.
And if you enter a bus or a shared taxi in most countries in Africa, it's not going to leave until it's full. In Uganda, I discovered this once. I was the first person into a 50-seater bus, which left 5 or 6 hours later.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
So it's all about, you know, filling it up, right. making every person pay, and then they will leave.
Sure.
So it's quite interesting. But anyway, Sao Tome and Principe.
Probably the way it should be most places.
Well, absolutely.
Really,
you know,
right?
it's much
You're
more
using
fun
the fuel and everything. You know,
that's true. And at least you get to talk to your fellow passengers. Yeah. You know, although it's a little bit annoying. You know, arriving 5 or 10 hours later.
6 hours, yeah, for sure.
But Sao Tome and Principe, it's a fantastic, it used to be Portuguese. You have the best chocolate in the world. You
really?
have a fabulous chocolatier there. His name is Claudio, and he's been made number one in many different chocolate competitions. He grows his own chocolate. He talks to his chocolate plants, you know, cocoa plants, I guess.
Yeah.
They're not chocolates until it's
really?
After the
talks
cocoa.
Talks to them.
He really takes care of them.
Yeah.
And the chocolate is amazing. It's so tasty. It's so good. So yeah, I interviewed him for my book. You have amazing food there. You have good infrastructure. It used to be, as I said, a Portuguese colony. Beaches, white beaches, black beaches. You know.
Do you get there?
You can fly from Lisbon, Portugal.
Okay,
there's still a direct flight from there. You can fly there from Ghana, from Nigeria, from Angola as well, I think. So you can fly there from several countries. But very few people have even heard about it. Yeah. It's an amazing place. Huh. And you have hiking opportunities. You have really fascinating mountains, mountain peaks, and so on. Hmm. Then you have, on the other side of Africa, another island group, the Comoros. And it's they speak French there. It's heaven for scuba diving or diving. Incredible beaches there as well. It's a dry country. Which means it's more or less Muslim. So if you're into booze, you should bring your own.
Dry as in no liquor, yeah.
No liquor, yeah. Well, hardly no liquor. You can get it in one. Well, probably the only luxury hotel on the island. You can get it if you really want.
Yeah.
But you know the turtles, the fish, the wildlife there, the plants. It's so green. It's incredible. It will buy more than make up for it. It's wow. It's really a fantastic place. Mm. So you should speak French there.
Okay.
And you should be patient because the roads around the main island especially are awful. So the average speed is going to be like 12, 15 miles per hour.
Okay, yeah.
But it's paradise.
Yeah. Yeah.
By all means. And very few tourists. So, and then you have a third country I'll mention is another island country. It's Solomon Islands in the Pacific. And you can fly there quite easily from Brisbane. I think it's a 3-hour flight. You can also fly there from Vanuatu and Papua New Guinea and some other countries. So it's fairly accessible, at least when it comes to Pacific standards. Some of these island countries are really hard to visit. Tuvalu, as I mentioned before, there are 3 or 4 propeller flights a week, and that's it. Sometimes
not
you
easy to get away on those weekend trips.
So for these countries. You need a little bit more time.
Yeah.
But again, Solomon Islands, it's one of the last countries where you had cannibals. It's totally safe now, but, it used to be a little bit more... you shouldn't venture into the forest too deep on your own.
Really?
Perhaps. Well, you can do now, but not previously.
Okay, yeah. But there are still cannibals there?
No, there are not. Well.
Okay.
At least none that we know of.
Okay.
But this is quite funny. If you go to Fiji, which is much more better known and where it's visited by lots of tourists... So it's not in my book, but they have a cannibal museum there. Well, they have a national museum. They have they were going to do a cannibal section in the museum. Of course, they and then the last person who was eaten, he was a British guy. There was nothing left of him. So the only thing they found was his shoes because the cannibals ate the rest.
So
his shoes are exhibited in the museum.
Wow.
So it's also
that's
very
crazy.
I think I was in the 60s or the 70s.
Okay, yeah.
When he was eaten, so it should be safe.
It should be. Well, I mean, I guess when you're getting down to the 20 least visited destinations, you are probably going to encounter some things along the way, right?
For sure.
So those three were three sort of island nations, I guess, that you would highlight. Were there any other you wanted to add to that list?
Well, you have 5 other countries, Tuvalu, Kiribati, and Nauru. You have Marshall Islands and the Micronesian Federation, all in the Pacific. They're all worth visiting. And you can get there fairly easily from the United States. You have the so-called island hopper. that's flown by United that goes from Honolulu and to Marshall Islands and then to Micronesia Federation. And from there, you can relatively easily visit the others. Yeah. But as I said, sometimes there are a few days between flights.
Right.
So you might you should set aside some
time. Yeah. I know there's probably a small percentage of people that are interested in traveling to maybe war-torn countries or some of these more dangerous places. And I mean, it would be probably a mistake on my part if I didn't ask you about what it's like to travel to some of those places, the kind of the first list you mentioned when you broke it up into two of the 20. And yeah, I'm just curious how that works logistically, I guess, traveling to those countries. And I just wanted to hear some experiences from the ground, because chances are, I mean, who knows in your lifetime how things will go, but I'm not probably going to any of those places anytime soon. So this is my chance to hear what it's like.
No, I mentioned Yemen, where I used to fixer.
Yeah.
So typically you should know someone on the ground. But I mean, of course, I never, not maybe not of course, there are some people out there that actually, they seek the frontier where, you know, where there is active fighting. I don't do that. You know, I don't, you know, I try to stay safe. I ask people on the ground. I try to get advice.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm not, I'm there to experience things. I'm not there to die, you know.
Right.
So typically, find someone local, get advice. A good way to do that is via social media, or it might be in your hotel, in the airport. You know, you ask around. To these countries, there are so few visitors that if you approach people and say, "Hey, I'm visiting as a tourist," well, first of all, they will probably think you're crazy. But it's, you know, after a few seconds, they will think, they'll be quite honored and say, "Wow, that's really nice." But even generally,
you're finding that people are surprised and honored, and that
they are indeed there, yeah. And they're very curious. So
this is kind of their chance to, they might not be able to do a lot of traveling out of some of these countries.
That's another thing. When you know, we are very lucky, we're from high income countries, we have strong passports, we can actually travel.
Yeah.
And then you think about it, and people are inviting us to weddings and dinners and hikes and boat trips and all the rest of it. And then you think about it, and we post this on social media, and we're so proud, and we get many likes, and, oh, look what I did on my holiday. I was invited to do this with some locals. But very few of us stop to think that, wow, don't you think those people that took us to those, you know, invited us on those things, those experiences, don't you think they would like to travel as well?
Yeah.
And most of them would. But, you know, they're not, they don't want to...
They can't do it.
Give you bad conscience, you know, and start talking about it. You know, I met this one guy in Costa Rica, and he told me, you know, I'm really inspired by all your traveling, all the rest of it. I only wish I could do it as well. You know, I'm never gonna make enough money. So it's you know, if traveling doesn't humble you as a person, I don't think anything will. But it's definitely worth thinking about. We are very, very lucky to be able to travel to different countries. And I think that's very important to keep in mind.
Yeah.
And then when it comes to traveling, you know, even Afghanistan, Somalia, South Sudan, Yemen, all these countries, they have safe zones. So, you know, so you can actually visit a war-ridden country if you want to and be safe, or relatively safe, or even very safe. Afghanistan, you have a province that's called Bamiyan, which is considered the only safe province in Afghanistan these days. It's the only place where they have a tourist office, for instance. And it's being visited by hundreds and thousands of locals, Afghanis, every year.
Okay.
You know, it's a beautiful area, and you're safe. There are very few weapons elsewhere in Afghanistan. You'll see weapons everywhere. You know, you'll see military vehicles everywhere. So it's also a break. And we're seeing that more and more Westerners are going there as well, to go even skiing and to hunt for archaeological sites and, you know, explore archaeological sites and so on. Very green, beautiful lakes and all the rest of it. So you can always find somewhere, almost always, you know. But I don't recommend people who hasn't really traveled much to make a war-ridden country their first destination, you know. It's the same as with anything else, baseball, football, soccer, singing, you know. You're not going to be world champion the first day you try something. Right, you know, it's about practice.
Yeah.
And I think that applies to travel as well. So, you know,
start
local and then gradually expand your horizon.
Go to Paris, then make your way to Afghanistan.
Yeah, there you go.
Just like that. I have no anchor, I guess, for what it's like to be in a war-torn country like that. And, I mean, even when you're in the safe zone, I guess you're still with locals, so you're getting a sense of what that is. I mean, what is it like... What is the vibe in Afghanistan, for example? Like, is it just, is it kind of, hey, we're just beat down all the way like this? This is constantly happening? Or are generally people just living their lives? And
people are generally living their lives. Yeah, and also in Kabul, the capital city of Afghanistan, there are almost 5 million people. So it's a fairly big city. I mean, there are as many people there as there are in entire Norway. So I was there, and there was a bomb blast. So it was a terror act of terror, and 57 people died. And I asked people, you know, a friend of mine, Bilal, and I asked him, how can you live like this? And say, well, it's life. We're not going to let terrorists, we're not going to make them win. We're not going to make them dictate how we're going to live our lives. So we take our precautions. You know, we look for hidden or unusual objects or people that behave suspiciously. We typically avoid big queues and stuff like that. But other than that, you know, we live our lives normally. And we're never going to let them win. And then he said something. And then again, you have to be good in statistics. I said, what? What do you mean statistics? Well, even the very sad events today, 57 people died.
Right.
It's in a city of 5 million people.
Yeah.
If you look at how many people die in a country of 5 million or, you know, in a city of 5 million people in traffic accidents and, you know, in by gun wounds, whatever else, you know, being hit by cars or and so on, it adds up. So you have to look at statistics. Yeah. It's very, very unlikely that's going to hit you. And, you know, it is a valid point.
Yeah.
And it's also a valid point for us as travelers. You know, yes, the only things we hear about from Afghanistan and South Sudan and Somalia, if anything, is about bomb blasts and terror.
Yeah.
And that was one of the reasons I wanted to write this book. It was to give a voice to normal people from unusual countries.
Right.
People you never hear anything about, because the only times you hear anything about these countries, it's bomb blasts and death and awful things. And you never hear about the normal people. I mean, they have kids there and they have schools there.
Sure,
everything is normal. They have restaurants. Everything is normal to a certain degree.
Right.
But, you know, we perceive these countries as a very abnormal, dangerous, awful, nasty places, because the only things we hear about are negative things.
And yeah,
so I'm trying
to
a certain tiny degree to change that.
To think about the statistics being like that gentleman you referred to, probably a very enlightened thing to do, right? In his position, like these things are going on all the time. And just to remember, oh, hey, this is not the majority of what's happening, and still having that positive outlook. And like you said, for travelers to remember that, I think it's good, because it dispels the fear of travel, really, when you keep that in mind. But that's not to say that, like you said, you shouldn't take precautions and be smart about things. But with a 24/7 media cycle, it does make it very difficult to, it is like almost like you have to make a conscious effort and do your own research and kind of be on top of it yourself to remind yourself that, hey, the world's not so bad. I mean, as a traveler, you know that too, because you go out in it. But even still, like, I haven't been traveling a ton lately, so it's not like I forget that. But you see all this terrible stuff on the news, and you have to remind yourself, hey, you know, the places I've been, you see people are just living their lives. They want the best for their children. They want a roof over their heads and food and all the basic things that everybody wants. And that's just the way it is everywhere. It's just being a human being, right?
But it's quite funny, though, because travel is being perceived as dangerous, per se. You know, everything now, you know, whenever you travel, when I travel, our mothers or, you know, parents or siblings, whoever.
Sure.
Be careful. Be safe.
Right, yeah.
And, you know, say, okay, so anything can happen, of course. But this is also the notion. If you travel, that, you know, you have to be safe, because that's perceived as dangerous. Then Bilal, who I told you about from Kabul, who I stayed with in his house, a very, very generous and very hospitable guy, journalist there, he traveled to Germany only in April, this April. And we're now Facebook friends, so you know, I get to see his feed and everything. And he posted a picture from Hamburg in Germany, and all his Afghani friends, you know, in a war-ridden country, on his wall, they're posting, "Be safe, careful."
Yeah. Right,
you
right.
Know, a guy from Afghanistan traveling to Germany, right, and even then, locals are saying, "Be safe," because being at home is considered safe. Being on the road is considered unsafe.
That's
even
incredible.
Even to Afghanis.
Right.
And that really blew my mind. I was like, wow, that's insane.
That kind of says it all.
Yeah, it does.
Right? It's just, it's human nature for a lot of it comes from love too. You know, I mean, of course, your mother or whoever is, they just don't want you to get hurt. But then they don't say, you know, you getting in the car to drive away, like, be safe. You're driving to the grocery store. Be safe, because obviously most accidents might happen in a car compared to different things. But you know, it's funny the things we focus on. But that's a great story. I love that. It's so funny. Just being in Germany, be safe. I mean, you need that anywhere.
One of the safest countries in the world.
I mean, since we're on the topic of safety, and you've been many places many times, have you had any sort of situations that were dicey?
In Somalia once, and it was about something as bizarre and as a fight over who was going to sit in front of the car, of the shared taxi.
A verbal fight or a physical fight?
No, it almost turned into a physical fight. But this friend of mine, his name was Tony, he was living in Somalia, and he organized a ride for me. He organized a shared taxi to go out of Somalia and back into Djibouti. But as I told you earlier, no shared taxi in Africa will leave until it's full.
Yeah.
But I was the first person in there because Tony had organized it. So I got to sit in front, the best seat, the passenger seat. Yeah. And then a lady comes along.
Shotgun.
Sorry?
Shotgun.
Shotgun. Yeah, exactly. I got a shotgun. So, you know, and then a lady came. She went back in the back seat. Another guy went into the back seat. And then so we're waiting for the last passenger. And finally, this guy, a little younger than me, with a huge knife in his belt, comes over. He opens my door and he grabs me by my collar and tries to pull me out. But of course, this really makes Tony mad, because, hey, come on, he's giving me the ride. He's giving me a shotgun.
Right.
So suddenly they have a really huge verbal fight, you know, over blah, blah, blah. And it's about, you know, losing face and everything. And he's giving me the seat and, you know. So in the end, Tony, he was bigger and older, so he wins. And in the end, this other guy with a big knife, he ends up just behind me.
Oh, great.
And I would have been happy to give up my seat. But suddenly, as this turned into a huge fight and losing face and all the rest of it, you know, losing your standing in society or whatever in the hierarchy, I couldn't just give up my seat that Tony had, you know, fought over.
Yeah.
So we were this close to a physical fight, but yeah, Tony sort of prevented that, you know.
Right.
But I was leaning forward the entire trip out. I was just waiting to be backstabbed, literally.
Yeah. Right. I mean, yeah, it must have been nerve-wracking ride for you. After a while, maybe it settled in a little bit, but...
it did indeed. And then I was robbed once. That was in Gabon.
Okay.
On the west coast of Africa, nearby Sao Tome and Principe, we talked about earlier. And I was walking in the middle of the road on the main street. It was fairly well lit. It was almost midnight. And suddenly two guys jumped me. And they managed to you know, push me, pull me. They have a taser gun, you know, get me into a dark side alley. And I've been thinking about this, you know, if I'm ever going to be robbed, I'm just going to give up everything. You know, I'm not here to die. You know, I treasure life, you know, and all the rest of it. But my instinct told me otherwise. So I started fighting back. And I've never been as strong in my life due to an adrenaline kick or whatever. And so I fought these two guys and managed to, you know, drag them back into the light of the main street. You know, then when they were in the street, in the light again, they ran away. They managed to steal my phone, and my shirt was totally ripped, and I was very shaken.
Yeah, I'm sure.
But, you know, and it was so stupid. You know, if they had a knife or a real gun, I would probably not have been here.
You know?
So, and even then, you know, I've been thinking about this, you know, for a lot of, you know, many, many times. You know, if I'm attacked, I should just give up everything.
Right.
It's not, you know, it's not worth losing your life over, you know, a few dollars and your wallet and a phone. And still, I fought back. Very stupid, but hey, that's insane.
I mean, sometimes. It's easy to say, it's easy to think about those things when you're kicking back at home or whatever, you're in your guest house or whatever. But then when it goes down, you don't know how you're going to react, right?
No. But, you know, I've been lucky. You know, I've been to every country in the world two times or more times. Right. And only two, you know, fairly.
Of course, maybe not the knife incident, but certainly the robbing can happen at home as
well.
That's
true. Yeah.
I mean, we're in Norway, and Oslo is a very safe country. And where my wife used to live, her friend walked out of her old apartment and got robbed right outside of her old apartment.
Yeah.
Hit on the head and robbed and all that.
No,
so
absolutely. It can happen anywhere. You know,
it can happen
unfortunately,
anywhere. Yeah.
But, that's right.
How has all this traveling changed your relationship to your home country of Norway?
It's very interesting to see your home country from a different perspective. So we are, both the United States and Norway, are within what I call the Western bubble. And to see the Western bubble from the outside and to realize that, well, of course, most people will know about the United States, but Norway, a lot of people don't even, never heard about Norway, you know. And, you know, probably heard about Europe, but not necessarily about your home country. And that is like, wow. So regardless where you're from, you might be from Rwanda or Burundi, or you might be from Kiribati or Paraguay or wherever, and you will consider your village, your town, your country as the center of the universe. That's just the way it is. Yeah. You know, that's where you're born. That's where you're raised. Yeah. You know, and that's home.
When you grow up, that's what you know.
Yeah, and you will look at everything in the world from that perspective, and realizing that made me think. You know, that, wow, so Norway is not the center of the universe. What's this? You know, they haven't even heard about the country. Right. You know, they know nothing about it. You know, they might think it's a village or a town or you know, a river.
The same way some of the countries you've mentioned today, we haven't heard about. Yeah. And those people there are thinking the same thing, right?
Yeah, exactly. So it's really eye-opening. And it's very humbling in many ways to realize that, you know, of course they look upon themselves, that their country, their culture, their religion, their faith, whatever, as the right way or the best way or whatever. And I'm not, you know, I'm in no position. I don't think anyone is in a position to say, oh, my way is better, or my religion is better, or my culture is better, or my food is better. You know, it might be, it might not be. It's different for sure. But let's just leave it at that. It's different.
Right.
And then if you think about it, okay, well, you might not agree, but hear them out at least, you know. Yeah. Be humble enough to let them speak and explain. And, you know, that might actually open up some doors. It might give you some new ideas. It might make you understand. And it might make you think differently. And then you take that back home and you think about it and you might learn a hell of a lot. You will learn a hell of a lot.
Yeah.
You know, and that's one of the beauties of a travel. I was once interviewed by a Norwegian newspaper, one of the biggest in Norway. And one of the things I said is that travel is the best education in the world. And then I was approached by a high school student here in Norway. And she asked if she could have a cup of coffee with me at work. So I invited her to the canteen at Norwegian Broadcasting. And, you know, and she said, well, I read that interview and I totally agree. The travel is the best education in the world. So when I finish high school, I'm just going to travel. I'm never going to go to college. And I said, oh, no, that's not exactly what I meant. Please, you know, go have an education. Just travel as well. You know?
Yeah.
So that was clearly misinterpreted very willingly,
from her. Yeah, that's funny.
And I've never heard from her again. So
I wonder what happened. Yeah. If you're listening, why don't you check in? When you're exposed to all these different cultures and ideas and perspectives and things, then you come back to your own culture. Have you found it at times like harder to fit in, or has it always been like a seamless transition just to come back from some grand things that you've done and just kind of slip right back into it? Or is it like slipping back into something that's unfamiliar and then you have to get familiar with it again? Like, what is that like for you?
No, I mean, this is my home. This is where I have my family. I have a lot of my friends here. Of course, I often meet new friends. But still, this is what I'm used to. At the same time, it gives me a different perspective.
Yeah.
It puts everything in perspective, and that's really valuable. And it makes me think in different ways when I'm back home. And I really like it at home. I really enjoy Norway as a country. Yeah, a little bit annoying, some of the people here, you know.
Everybody can say that about their own country, you know.
We're too shy, maybe. But at the same time, I do enjoy Norway and Norwegians. And I'm a very restless person. I have lots of energy. I'm quite restless.
No, you're not, right? No, you're not restless.
I'm lying. Yeah,
traveling around the world twice, every country.
So sometimes after a week or 2 weeks or a month, it's also like, I have to go somewhere. And it's not because I don't like it here. It's not because I hate my friends or my family. It's because it gives me so much to see the world through different glasses, if you like.
Yeah.
To experience different cultures and try different foods. And I don't know. And even if I've been to places before, then you notice new things. You notice changes.
Right.
And sometimes you know, there are no changes. Or it might be a subtle thing in the atmosphere. It might be new buildings, very physical things. But, or you might notice, it's been 9 years since I've been here. they've really started, you know, it's really started improving here, you know, people, less poor people, yeah, no slums anymore, perhaps, and so on. So usually you see positive changes.
Yeah.
And of course, you've met people before, so you come back and you revisit them. And so it's really valuable to have friends in so many countries around the world.
Yeah. This area we're in right now, Toyin, is an example of that. It's changed a lot over the years. I found, like, it's just really, yeah, neighborhoods change, cities are always evolving, but I think we can tend to just get back to a physical place like our hometown or something and just always think of it as the same because we spent our childhood there, say, for example. But of course it's not the same place. It's 20 years older or 30 years older or 40 years older, whatever the case is. So it's a different place. But I do think sometimes travel helps you see that a little bit differently. You mentioned Norwegians being shy. What is it about that bums you out? You sound a little bummed out about that.
Like, no,
what do you mean by that? It's like, you're talking about the Jantelova thing? We were talking about that a little bit before the interview. Is that what you're talking about?
No, I'm not bummed out about it. It's more like jokingly.
But, yeah.
Because we are being perceived by lots of people abroad as being aggressive or not, maybe not aggressive, but arrogant. You know, we're... If we don't know people, we don't tend to say hello.
That's your version of politeness, though, right? From what I understand, it's like not bothering people is kind of like you're sort of being polite and staying out of the way.
That's probably that's the way we're thinking about it.
Right.
But we're losing
it's not,
out
it's not like a bad intention.
No bad intention.
No.
So that's what I'm saying when people are complaining, but what? Are you Norwegian? But you're not so arrogant. And I said, No, we're not arrogant. We're just trying to stay out of your way, but that makes us lose out on so much. Because we don't meet people, you know. We don't have that welcoming smile very often, unfortunately, to people we don't know. And that is so sad. I mean, it's totally free to smile.
Yeah.
And it shows that you have no bad intentions. You know, you're here in peace. And people should smile more and just say hello.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that, you know, you're going to talk to someone for an hour.
Right.
But it's sort of saying that, hello, I'm friendly, I'm here in peace, you know, I'd love to get to know you.
Right.
And I think that is something I think that's a bad trait, if you like.
It's funny because you're not the only one to tell me this. I mean, I've heard this from across the board. So it seems like almost everybody unanimously agrees that they should just talk to each other more. So, hey, everybody, let's get it started now. I'm shouting out to the bar right now. just get it started right now, guys. All right, you on the street. Let's start talking. It's interesting because I think I get, as an American, and we're very chatty. We talk to a lot of people. And, like, you know, there's been times I'm paying for something at a gas station, and, like, 2 minutes later, I'm getting their life story. You know, it's just the way it is from the cashier. But I get to engage a little bit more, I think, here because I am not from here and I get a little bit of a pass. And when I start speaking Norwegian or whatever, they immediately know I'm
absolutely
not from here.
Yeah.
And it's just like, oh, okay, you probably don't know that we're not supposed to talk to each other right now. But people seem to really enjoy that. And my wife comments on that too when we travel. She's kind of says the same thing, same sentiment that you just expressed.
Yeah.
Like, oh, it just would be nice if we...
Yeah, if people spoke to us.
But,
you know, Norwegians listening, we're not going to speak
on,
to you if you don't smile.
Guys and gals, let's get it going here. Let's get the smiles going. No, but like we said, it's not like a bad intention thing. It's just it's just cultural.
I think it is. No, for sure.
I actually have one more topic to cover before we get into some quick-hitting questions that I got from my community, because I posted something that said, hey, I'm talking to the guy that's the only guy that's traveled to every country in the world twice. What do you want to know? What kind of questions do you want me to ask him?
Yeah.
And I got some questions from them, so I'm going to ask you those. You have some interesting takes on sustainable travel, and this is something I've been thinking about a lot recently, and you've probably been following the news of over-tourism and, of course, climate change and everything related to carbon dioxide in the air and everything like that. I'm not an environmental scientist, as you can hear, as I'm rattling on about this, but I think everybody gets the gist of what I'm saying. And oftentimes, you know, travel or excessive travel is something that is kind of pointed to as maybe an unnecessary contribution to a bad environmental impact. I know you have some kind of thoughts and some statistical like analysis around this. So even in Norway, there's a new term that's been popping up, fleecegum. Isn't that like a popular thing now?
Yeah, it translates something like plane shame.
So like flight shame, yeah.
Flight
it's like
shame,
you should be ashamed of traveling. It's like it's almost becoming, from what I understand, not cool to just travel somewhere on a plane because you're contributing to the problem. So what's going on? What are your thoughts
on this? No, I think this term, and it came from Sweden originally, but it's our language is very similar to Swedish. So we're using the same term here. I think there are good intentions behind this term, but I think it can be dangerous. And one of the reasons why is that you focus very specifically on one way of polluting, flying. And by doing that, you sort of forget all the other ways that we actually pollute. If you look at the figures, the aviation industry contributes 1.9, let's say 2% of pollution of CO2, which leaves 98%. And I think we should look at the full picture. Because if the danger here, and the reason I'm saying it's dangerous, is that saying, well, okay, so I'm flying less. So I'm going to fly 20% less or 50% less, or I'm going to stop flying altogether. And then you might think that, oh, well, then that's it. I've done that's my contribution. So, and I don't think about how the car I own or the pet I own. The pet industry, the pet food industry actually pollutes more than the aviation industry. So does fabric, textile, clothing, fashion industry, twice as much as flying. And you can go on and on, you know, personal cars pollute a lot. The military pollutes probably the most of all industries. We have to cut down on our pollution, for sure. Otherwise, we're in big trouble. We're already in big trouble. We're looking at a climate crisis here. But to look at only one thing and one thing only, that's counterproductive. And if you think about it, we're living in a capitalist or at least semi-capitalist society, depending on which country you're in. So let's say, okay, I'm cutting down 50% on my flying. That means I'm saving a lot of money. What will I do with that money? Okay, well, maybe I'll buy a car. You know, see, if you buy a car, a medium size, or let's say a small petrol car, or a big electrical car like a Tesla or a Jaguar, that's the same as 30 average flights a year. During the
just buying it, not just the pollution,
well, no, buying and driving, right, driving
okay,
it
yeah,
average.
Got it, yeah.
I mean, if you buy it, you're probably going to drive it. But if you own it for the average lifespan of a car, which is 16 years,
yeah,
and you drive it the average amount, that's going to set the climate back with 3 tons of CO2 a year. But and then say, hey, but electrical car, they don't pollute as much, but producing that battery, that very big battery, that emits a lot of CO2. So you have to sort of, so if you divide it by 16 years, which is the average lifespan of a car, and you drive, I think it's 10,000 miles a year, which is the average currently, then you end up with 3 tons of CO2 a year, which is the same as almost about 25 average flights a year. And so I'm not saying that, no, we definitely should fly less. And if we fly, I think we should fly to unusual destinations. So we don't see what we're seeing now in Venice. We're seeing in Barcelona. We're seeing in some other cities that, you know, people are starting to hate tourists because there's so many of them.
Yeah.
And then, you know, then we act like sheep. We, you know, everybody goes seeing the same thing.
Yeah.
We never speak to any locals. You know, locals hate us. The only thing they like about us is that we leave some tourist dollars there. You know, so there's no mutual understanding. There's no mutual respect. We don't learn from each other. We're sort of just there for transactions.
Right, right.
But if we travel differently, and if we, let's say we travel to maybe not the least visited countries in the world, but let's say not to Spain and France and the United States for our sake, and Italy, we and Britain maybe. Let's say let's go to Africa or Southeast Asia, or we go to South America, and we engage with the people there. We achieve a better understanding. I think we can also lower conflict levels.
Yeah.
Which again should lead to a conclusion that, hey, let's spend less on the military, because the military is the worst, or yeah, probably the worst. Their emissions are more or less secret. They are not too keen on publishing those. But estimates show that the military is the worst polluter in the world. And now NATO, with the U.S. President Trump in charge, they want to increase military spending in NATO by 40%. And the world has never been more peaceful than now. And when you look at the military, how much they pollute, you know, that's essentially a 40% increase in pollution as well. Because if NATO does this, so will our so-called enemies, you know, Iran, Russia, China, et cetera, We have a vicious circle. Everybody is going to increase their military spending by 40% and military pollution by 40%, which is bad and totally unnecessary. You know, it's all about making more money. But if you look at it differently and let's travel differently, we actually we meet people. Let's travel to Russia more. Let's travel to Iran more. And we will realize that, wow, these people are amazing. They're so friendly. The governments might not be, but most people are, you know. So again, we should we should divide governments. We should look at governments and people through different binoculars, if you like.
And seeing that big picture, as you mentioned.
And let's say that we by doing this, we do actually reduce conflict, and we don't have to increase military spending. If you look at that, if we increase 40% military spending by 40%, that will emit as much as four times what the entire aviation industry does across the world. So again, it's you know, yes, I fly a lot, which means I don't have money to spend on a lot of other things that actually also pollute. But I think by traveling, meeting people, inspiring other people to think differently, to learn about other cultures and so on and so forth, if more people do that, that will have a positive impact also on climate. We should travel less, but when we travel, how about we travel differently? And we have to look at every industry here. We cannot just look at one, travel, flying. We have to look at them all, and we should reduce our emissions within every industry. And that's the danger about flying shame or plane shame or whatever it's called. You see the same with beef production. So now, typically in the media, in on the top, you know, on the top of the heads of the of politicians, they're mentioning flying and beef. Typically, maybe recycling. So let's say we do something about those three things and we forget the rest, you know, then it's awful. Cement production, steel production accounts for 16% of all emissions in the world. You know, so building, we should build in wood instead and so on. So there's so many things we can do, and we have to do all of these things at the same time.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, you mentioned meat and travel. I mean, those things can be perceived as voluntary, right? We don't have to travel. We don't have to eat meat. But then also, do we have to increase military industrial spending by 40%?
I don't think so.
You know, it's, you know what I mean? So, yeah, a very interesting perspective.
And you also look at trade. You know, if we stop all traveling or all flying, you know, the trade will suffer tremendously, which is one of the reasons why some people want to boost military spending is, you know, to boost trade, to increase the number of jobs and so on. So it all comes together. And let's say we will outlaw flying tomorrow. From tomorrow, it's not going to be allowed to fly anywhere in the world. Let's say we do this. That will cut CO2 emissions by 2%. If that's all we do, that's not going to help. Yeah. It's going to help a tiny bit, but it's not going to help. It's not going to solve the climate crisis. We have to do more things than just... We have to look at more...
Can you solve it, Gunnar? Oh. We need to... Ooh, it didn't break. Yay.
It didn't break.
Sorry. This is like the... I just knocked over a water glass.
Jason, you shouldn't have...
I've only had this one. Maybe
on.
Had
that was
two
vodka
beers.
That glass, wasn't it?
I'll tell you what. This is the second drink I spilled today. I was in the grocery store earlier, and I knocked over my ginger ale. Then I knocked over the milk. It's been a spill day. All right, let me get to some of these. You ever have those days? You know, you just got butterfingers. You
absolutely
drop everything everywhere.
I think there must have been vodka in that glass. It was not a water glass.
No, that was just water, I promise.
I
was going to ask you to solve climate change crisis right before we got there, but I don't think you can do that. All right, let me get into some of these questions from our community. I put something out there and said, what do people want to know? So Rachel asked, and some of these I'm sort of paraphrasing, but what gear would you never leave home without on your trip? So some things you consider essential, I guess, when it comes to travel gear.
Yeah, well, I never travel without my suit jacket.
Your suit jacket, which you're wearing right now?
I'm wearing it right now.
Yeah, and looking sharp.
Well, thank you. Yeah. Well, that's one reason. You will get a better treatment. Mm. Yeah, a higher chance of upgrades, better rooms and hotels. But also, you have inner pockets, you know, so I have all the belongings I need. You know, people can steal my luggage. I don't really care. Of course, it's unfortunate, but hey, it's not going to kill me. I have on my in my inner pockets, I have my wallet, I have my money, I have my phone, and I have my passport. And that's it, you know. And I get treated better by traveling this way.
Right.
You know, so no, I never travel without my suit jacket.
I guarantee nobody that I've interviewed would ever answer with a suit jacket. I just love this answer so much. Okay. That's so awesome. And I love that you're wearing it. We can't forget about...
I do change it occasionally, I must say. Yeah. No,
well, I mean, all right, before we move on to this next question, we should come back to what I promised before, which was going to be the backpack story that we were talking about before we started recording. Well, we'll get to that at the end, I guess. All right. So Mira asks, how do you decide how long you'll stay in a place?
Well, usually it's limited by my lack of holiday.
Okay.
So almost always I want to stay longer than I actually can.
Based on what you have going on.
Yes, yeah, of course. And, you know, I only have my limited holiday. And the longer I stay, the longer I want to stay. Because, you know, you get to know people, you get to know the community. You understand what's really happening and what you should really see. And you see beyond the tourist attractions, if there are any. And, you know, and then you say, oh, I wish it's... Most people probably say that when they travel. I wish I could stay longer.
Yeah.
And some people actually mean it as well.
Right. Yeah. Sometimes you know, you're ready to go home,
sometimes but... right. Yeah, so it's unfortunately, it's usually determined by the available time. And, you know, then you have something else planned. You know, you might have to go to... You have a meeting or you have an engagement or something. So
yeah, okay.
It's usually something else that's happening that limits the time, the amount of time I have in a place.
Right on.
But if I could, I would, you know, I'd stay for weeks and weeks and months and months in every country. But yeah, so if any sponsors out there, you know, make this happen.
Well, my dad's chiming in now. He asked because I texted him. And the first question he said was, ask him if he's tired. I said, no, I'm not asking him if he's tired. Give me like a real good question, you know. So he said, if you could go back to only one country before you die, which one would it be? So I'm going to add some caveats to this. Let's say your home country is excluded.
Yeah.
You're going to die a peaceful death in like a month and you have to go spend a month somewhere. Where are you going to go?
Ooh, that's a tricky one. I get some form of this question or another. Probably
I know it's hypothetical, but it's
but,
fun.
Yeah,
good
no,
thought experiment.
It's a tricky one. I would have to, I'd say New Zealand. I really like it in New Zealand.
Oh, wow.
It's
high on my bucket list.
I
want a camper van
country.
Through there. I want to buy the camper van and do the whole thing.
But I mean, it's sort of a lame answer, really, because in many ways it's similar to Norway. So maybe I should rather say, you know, so you get me going. You know, if I say one country, I'm going to have to say another.
Yeah,
and it was actually funny. It was an American magazine called The Thrillist.
Yeah,
and they asked me if I could name my favorite country, and I said, "No, that's impossible."
Yeah.
But can you give us a list of 10? And I said, "Well, I can give you a list of 12 countries that are incredible and that I can recommend anyone to visit." Oh, they're fabulous. So why 12? Yeah, two from each continent. I said each inhabited continent. Yeah. I said, "Oh, that's fine, but there is one precondition: you cannot rate them. You cannot say there's this number one, there's number 12." And they were fine with that.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I never want to do that. It's unfair to any country.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I gave them a list. And naturally, this was an article. So they had to start somewhere. They didn't number it, but they started with Romania in Europe. And 2 or 3 days later, every news outlet, every TV station, every radio station in Romania called me and said, "Oh,
really?
You're saying Romania is the best country in the world?" No, that's amazing. That's not what I meant. Oh, that's why? Okay, yeah, whatever. I'll just go with the flow. Yeah, Romania is the best country in the world. You know.
Sure. You guys want to fly me there? Put me up.
So that was funny. But you know, I can't say this country is the best in the world. But I must say, I refuse to ask that question. Like New Zealand and the people there and the scenery, and it's so diverse. So New Zealand is definitely an amazing country.
Sounds like I got some bucket list reshuffling to do. Okay. Harold was asking something along the lines of that. If you're going to go back to any countries that you want to spend months or even years at, which ones would they be? So that kind of covers that as well. I'm taking my phone because I got another question right before you came in, and it's, how does he feel he's changed the most from his exposure to the world, and what places in the world are in the biggest impact on you?
Oh, that's a deep question. No, I think it comes down to the small things, really. Just seeing, I was in Somalia and I visited a camp for internally displaced people. because they can't call them refugees, because refugees go from one country to another.
Yeah.
But because of droughts and lack of food, you know, I saw this, and I met this tiny little girl and her mother, and she stayed in a tent, 6 square meters tent with 4 kids and a husband. And it was just heartbreaking. It just really made an impact. And just talking to her and realizing how they lived from, you know, getting 2 meals a day. It was always the woman, the mother, who had to stand in line to get the food, right, the little food they got as a mixture of beans and rice, because that was you know, the man that would that was, you know, not his job, you know, that was below his dignity to stand in line to get this little amount of food that they had to share between 6 people. And when I was there, the food was still on the plate. And I said, why don't you eat her? You have 4 really hungry kids, including this very tiny, extremely cute girl, probably aged 2 or 3. I said, no, my husband gets to eat first. So when he's finished, we eat the rest. Again, a very patriarchal society, and really, really sad. Just realizing, you know, these things, how...
happen every day.
They happen every day. And it's so sad and heartbreaking. And still, it's inspiring. You know, they're still going for it. They're really trying to find ways of making a living, trying to... The mother is trying to educate her little daughter, her daughters, and it's sad in many, many ways, and at the same time, it is empowering to see, you know, how they're having to fight through this patriarchal society, and, you know, all the obstacles there.
Mm.
Wow. Inspiring in many ways, and also the opposite.
Yeah, yeah. It's I can get very overwhelmed when you think about the things that go on every day.
Yeah.
Around the world.
Yeah.
You know, when you see it, and you know, you witnessed it, it's different than.
Absolutely, and it's daily life to lots of people, and we don't think about it. We don't have to think about it, and it's uncomfortable to think about it, which is why we don't visit these places.
Yeah,
because it sort of reminds us it reminds us how lucky we are.
Yeah,
and you know, we'd rather not be reminded how lucky we are. We just, you know, sort of ignore that.
Yeah,
and I understand totally why. You know, don't have a problem with that.
Yeah,
and, it is still reality.
Overwhelming, emotionally. I mean, I feel that. Okay, Lance was asking, I wonder if he feels like he has been able to be of service to local peoples in some of the countries. I think, like, some of the things we touched on is, like, you know, some of these people aren't going to get to travel. So one way that I think is by, you know, being a mini ambassador to a country that somebody's never going to visit, but they're curious and they're genuinely interested and they're excited to meet you. I think there's an element of that there in some way, and, like, you're having a human interaction, right? So it's anytime you have that, whether it's people from 2 different countries or what we're having here, it makes some kind of impact, right? Can't not. We're all interacting with the world. I mean, I don't know what your thoughts on this. I just went on a rant there. But
no, I think it's about trying to get stories out, trying to give normal people, or, you know, people you'll never hear from, countries you'll never hear from otherwise, to get those stories out and make that normal.
Yeah,
you know, to get beyond those headlines, that might be the only thing you hear about. When I travel, I interact with people. I help out. I help them fishing for dinner. You know, help them pick potatoes in their on their little, I wouldn't even call it a farm, but their little patch of land. You know, little things. You know, go in the slum in the slums in India and talk to people, help out a little bit. But I'm not into. I really don't like to give money to beggars. And if you've seen Slumdog Millionaire, the movie, or read the book, you know that in many places, in several countries, especially maybe in India and China, begging is a source of it's organized by criminal syndicates. So the beggars will never get the money. You know, that will all go to the wealthy and the filthy rich. Criminals behind it. And in order to get more sympathy, they might take, you know, if you're a beggar and if you're a lady, they will take your daughter and they will break her kneecap in order to create more sympathy so they can get more money. So I never give money to beggars, but I help in other ways. You know, I might provide them with food, you know, talk to them, chat
company,
with them.
Company, yeah.
Try to get their stories about, you know. Help them pick firewood and stuff like that.
Yeah.
My goal has been to share stories and hopefully try to inspire people and maybe get them to see things from different perspectives. You know, I'm sad to say I've never, you know, helped build schools or things like that. It might be something because I really believe in education. I think education is probably the most important thing out there. So if I were, and I will, then I'll probably be engage myself into educational purposes.
Yeah, that's great. That's probably the best way of helping,
in my opinion.
One more, Jesse asked, I think this is a good one. Is there a place that you felt very different about the second time, either in a positive or negative way?
Many places. Traveling back to, again, South Sudan, for instance, again, a country at war. And coming back, and it's been at war for such a long time. And, you know, after, I think it was 8 or 9 years between my visits there and coming back and seeing that, oh, the war is still happening.
Yeah.
Still very, very corrupt. Same politicians are in power. And, you know, they're taking pretty much all the money that they're getting in through taxes and all the rest of it. The soldiers are being deployed. You know, they're raping women. They're killing men. They're burning down houses and villages and all the rest of it. And just seeing that it's still like that. You know, there was so much hope when I was there. It's the youngest country in the world. In 2011, it became independent from the rest of Sudan. And, you know, there's so much hope back then. And although there, you know, there was some war episodes and, you know, violence, but, you know, they were hopeful. And then coming back seven, eight years later, and it's much, much worse, you know. Mm. So that was, I was really saddened
to stand out, something that stands out. Yeah.
I know they, the world community were on their side. They're really being pushed, you know, collected a lot of money to the newest country in the world. And then, you know, everything is taken away by greedy politicians, spending it on themselves and not the people. And there's a full scale war going on in big parts of the country. So. Very, very, very sad.
Yeah. We covered quite a bit today. Last thing we got to cover is the fact that your backpack has been every country in the world. This is what we were talking about before and joking about, which I think is just, this is just phenomenal, the lengths at which you'll go to complete a quest. This is kind of illustrates this, which I think is great. So tell us really quickly the backpack story, because you realized at some point your backpack had almost been to every country in the world. And
oh,
then
yes.
What?
My old my old friend, my backpack.
Yeah.
I was given it in 2004, so it's 15 years. And last year, I sort of started thinking, oh, my backpack's been to almost every country. And I started counting. It'd been to 193 countries, only five countries I hadn't been to. And those were Peru, Uruguay, Mongolia, San Marino, and Monaco. Yeah. And I was going to go back to the three first of those anyway for my second time to every country, but not to San Marino and Monaco. And then I asked my girlfriend, Caroline, she's from England, and I said, hey, do you fancy going to Italy? And I mean, San Marino is inside Italy, and Monaco is bordering Italy.
Yeah.
So, or almost bordering Italy. And I said, yeah, let's go to Italy. And I sort of failed to mention that we had to go to San Marino and Monaco just so that my backpack could actually have touched the ground. And I also failed to mention...
Your backpack didn't have to spend a night there.
No, I
just
didn't.
Had to touch
the
ground.
No, that's true, yeah. So we actually had a dinner in San Marino. And it turned out this little trip involved 10, 12 hours on the road, which I failed to mention. So I
thus
had
the
to,
karmic circle is complete.
Absolutely, yeah. I think I compensated fairly well by taking her to some amazing restaurants both in San Marino and in
Italy.
Well,
we'll have to have her on the podcast to ask her.
Yeah, well, absolutely. Yeah. Well, that's true. No, don't do that. Don't do that. No.
That's great. So you.
So now it's been to every country in the world, and I met with a friend of mine in Thailand, and she runs a small bag company. I said, oh, my backpack has been to every country in the world, and she said, oh, maybe we should make a version of it.
Yeah.
I said, really? So now they're actually, the end of the story, the company is called NIN, N-I-N. It's a very small company. And they're now making a version of my backpack. So they're using my original backpack as a prototype. And they're naming it gonna go for us.
Yeah. Honor,
so
right?
It's funny. You know, it's really funny. So we will see. Hopefully they're going to sell it in Norway as well and Thailand. Yeah, that's awesome, very cool.
That's hilarious. I just love that you... Yeah, had to get that backpack to every country. Well, yeah. Like, you just had to do it. It's in your blood, man.
I guess, I don't know.
It is in your blood. But cool. Well, thank you so much for your time. I had a blast chatting with you. I hope we can do this again at some point. And yeah, just share with everybody one more time, like, your website, where people can find you, your book, anything else.
Absolutely. It's all of my last name, Garfors, G-A-R-F-O-R-S, Garfors. It's garfors.com. I'm Garfors on Instagram, on Twitter, on Facebook, on wherever else people Twitter, wherever people go. And so that's probably the best way to find me, just look for my last name.
Yeah, and the book is not out yet, but it's being worked on getting published.
It's out in Norwegian.
Right. But
I actually have an agent. You know, it's the first time in my life.
It's actually being an agent, right. You congratulations. Know, well, it must have been that suit jacket.
That got you the agent,
man. So that's awesome. Anytime, of course, I wrap these things up in person, I like to do a high five it out.
Right, it was
awesome, man.
Thank you, Jason.
Thank you so much for your time. Had a blast. Thanks.
Thank you.
There you have it, my chat with Gunnar Garfors, who is a special, cool, awesome dude that has quite an accomplishment there, traveling to every country in the world twice. I hope you enjoyed listening in on our conversation there. We were huddled up in a booth just talking travel over beers. It was fantastic. Looking forward to meeting up with him again soon, and hope you really enjoyed the chat. Now, I thought it was hilarious when he said that the thing he couldn't travel without was his suit jacket, which is one of the last things I would have thought of as sort of a minimal traveler, having traveled to so many places. I just thought that was fantastic and, totally unique. And for me, the one item that I just got to have with me, that sort of, I won't call it a luxury item, but kind of you could live without it, but I can't live without it, it's my Kindle. I need to have my Kindle because I love to read, and I love to read at night in bed. So that Kindle, I'm obsessed with it. I just can't imagine going without it. But now, you know, Gunnar has me thinking about a suit jacket, perhaps. Is a suit jacket in my future for traveling? I don't know. Probably not, but maybe. Maybe. If you're listening, Gunnar, maybe you can find me a nice fit. Something that doesn't wrinkle too much, because I ain't going to do any ironing. I'm not going to iron the thing. I don't have time for the ironing. I'm not saying you ironed it. I'm sure you didn't. But anyway, thanks again for listening to this show. And I want to leave you with a quote, I guess. I always do that. And it's nice to sign off with a quote. Before I do, I want to quickly say thanks again to Tortuga Backpacks for supporting today's show. ZeroToTravel.com/Tortuga takes you to the page with the backpacks I recommend, the gear I recommend from them. And if you enter the promo code TRAVEL when you check out, just the word TRAVEL, you get 10% off anything you order. They actually just came out with a women's backpack, which is tailored more to women, obviously. It's a 35-liter pack, and that's something new that they just launched. And I'm just a huge fan of their stuff. I've been using their backpacks for years. Do not waste your time doing a bunch of research, trying to figure out, hey, which backpack should I take around the world with me for a year or for the summer? See what I recommend. Check them out. ZeroToTravel.com/Tortuga. Promo code TRAVEL. Get 10% off. Treat yourself to some awesome travel gear. And thanks to them for supporting today's show. And before I let you go, a little quote here from the late, great physicist Stephen Hawking, who said... This is small thinking, right? He said, my goal is simple. It is a complete understanding of the universe, why it is as it is, and why it exists at all. Such a simple goal. But I love this quote because of how big it is, but also how he just says, this is my goal, and it's simple. And I think my guest today kind of exemplifies this quote, maybe not for the whole universe, but for our Earth. You know, how can you understand the planet that we live on? The best way to understand it, I think, is to travel and to see it, to meet the people that inhabit it, to experience the cultures that exist upon it, all of that and more. And I just wanted to leave you with that. So go forth and enjoy
your travels, wherever they take you over the next week, month, year, even if you're traveling to the town next to you, it can still be an adventure. You can still approach it like a traveler and see the culture of that town with a fresh perspective. Interact with some people you've never talked to before. Put yourself out there, do something a little different, a little wild. Have that travel attitude everywhere you go, anywhere you go, because you can be a traveler inside and that can shape your experience anywhere you are, even if you're just at home. So enjoy it. Love this earth we live on. I love you, my friend. Thank you so much for being a part of this community. I really do appreciate you. And this podcast exists for you. So if you ever want to get in touch, just share your story. Say what's up. Let me know what you thought of this show, any of the shows, any guests you want me to have on, topics you want me to cover, stories you want to share about your own travels, your life, whatever. Drop me a line. I read them all. Jason@zerototravel.com. Thanks so much again. And I'll see you next time. Peace.
This podcast has been brought to you by ZeroToTravel.com. Ideas and advice to make your travel dreams a reality.